Good evening, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Bog, which is live every single Wednesday here on DLive.tv/Dave Martell at 6 p.m. Eastern. We got a really, really awesome topic tonight. One of my favorite topics, and a favorite topic of many, many history buffs out there that really love to read about ancient history and history in general. But we're going to talk about it now, not just from a historical standpoint, but also from the standpoint of religiosity as well. But like always, before we get started, make sure to go over to facebook.com/ironagejodish and check out some authentic Vedic astrology. I'm getting more and more messages from Mr. Neil John over there at Iron Age Jodish, and also he's going to be coming up here, coming back for another episode of The Bog, I believe 2 weeks from now, something like that. So we're going to have him back on. But if you want to find out what the stars say about you and your life and your future in authentic Vedic astrology, go over to facebook.com/ironagejodish and tell them Big Dave sent you. If you like what we do, you want to support what we do, you can go over to patreon.com/thebog and sign up. You sign up over there, there's a bunch of different stuff. You can get stickers, t-shirts, blah, 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 all kinds of stuff over there. So if you enjoy what we do and you want to help us keep the lights on, go over to patreon.com/thebog and you go sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50, as well as an RSS feed for all patrons so you can listen to our audio. It uploads right away to whatever podcast app you're using on your phone or computer, so you can listen at home, in the car, at the gym, or at work, or wherever you may be on your commutes. And also, if you want to support us another way, you could go over to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop, which is down in the bottom right corner of the screen, and go check out our store. All kinds of awesome stuff. T-shirts, long sleeves, hoodies, artisan chef aprons, insulated stainless steel bottles for when you're at the gym to keep your drinks cold. All kinds of stuff, man. Really, really great stuff. We even have like onesies for babies and phone cases and cups and all kinds of stuff over there. Hats, whatever you can think of, we got over there. So go to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop, as it says in the bottom right corner there, and go check it out. Support the Bog. Support your boys so we can keep going. We can keep the lights on and we keep growing and keep making more content for everybody. So tonight, Return of the Ancient Kings. We are going to talk about something that is very, very important to us and very important, what was very important to our ancestors, and that is the concept of kingship itself and how that applies to us as modern believers of the ancestral faith, because our ancestors put a lot of stock and a lot of belief into their kings that were walking around, and there's a lot that goes into understanding what kingship means. But like always, I got the full Bog panel tonight. Tristan, Wolfman, Andre, how we doing, guys?
I'm doing pretty good today, Dave.
Excellent.
Doing fine myself.
I'm doing pretty good.
Good stuff. So let's get started. Tristan, why worship or revere kings?
Well, kings have to be understood as some of the most noble and illustrious of all possible ancestors that you could possibly contribute yourself back towards. Many people are, in fact, descended from kings in some various sense that they don't even realize, because generational relations tend to favor noble and wealthy factors as you go back up the lineage. Just due to the way sociology and nature works, it's more common for people to be born from noble lineages. So kings are also, you have to understand, as they have what we would call a special hominia, that they're connected to the land and the people in a way that other people simply are not. And that's why they were elected to be kings as part of a specific lineage. So to understand why you should follow and revere kings more than other people is because our own ancestors believed that they were in fact special even while living, and they're doubly important and special when they're dead as ancestors.
Very cool. And Mr. Ian, you had something you wanted to say about kingship as well and kind of your take on it.
Well, I guess from a kind of historical perspective, since my favorite area of history is the early medieval period, late classical period, kind of, you know, the Germanic period before Christianization. I think a lot of times I'm guilty of this myself. We as, you know, non-Christians tend to kind of lose interest when conversion happens. Like, the Saxons' history is fascinating. And then Wittekind loses and it's like, oh, well, they're Christian now. And suddenly my interest is fading. I'm real guilty of that. I think a lot of people are, based on conversations I have and just the general trend. But something that, as a real fan of Teutonic military history, be it, you know, the migrations of the Marcomanni to, you know, Otto defeating the Magyars at Lechfield and all that, I think it's important to remember that your ancestors, even post-Christianization, still kind of carried that that spirit with them, that blood with them, of those old kings. And that's important. So like Charlemagne, for example, a lot of us despise him for very obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. But that whole kind of will to power sort of that king's blood, really, it's, for whatever nefarious purpose it ends up coming out to be, it's still a very potent factor within all of our lives. And that's just an important thing, I think, to keep in mind when you study this sort of thing.
Yeah, and I also want to say to the chat real quick, let me know if my audio or my levels aren't very good. I was messing with some of the audio settings on my stuff, so if it sounds uneven, if I'm lower or they're lower or whatever, let me know in the chat so I can adjust it on the fly. But you know, when it comes to kingship, this is something that we're kind of bred, especially here in the United States, where Enlightenment philosophy is kind of, you know, the core of Americanism. We are taught, we are bred to believe that kings are tyrants and kings are evil and kings are this and that. So, Mr. Tristan, how would, like, kingship be different from the kind of view of it that we are brought up with?
Well, I think the difference here really goes down to the base fundamental philosophical distinction of what is a king and why is a king a king. In the liberal tradition, a king is often viewed as a tyrant who has usurped the sort of people's right to self-governance and is falsely claiming some sort of divine right that never actually existed. Whereas in older systems, the divine right is actually very explicit and very connected with religious matters, such as I was talking about, that kingly lineages maintain and possess a special familia that other people do not. It's very much an explicit and actual thing that they have that other people do not have, and that's why kings are different than other people, and that's why the institution is there. It can be traced back to the Rigstula. The god Rig gave us the position of kingship through the through Jarl and his son Con the Kingly, who was the first king.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, even from a purely academic standpoint, you could make the case that, you know, a king is made, especially in, you know, Teutonic culture, it's like, you know, the strongest, the wisest of the locality of the tribe, who is that way because more or less his subordinates, his neighbors, bend their knee to him. And not necessarily in like a cruel tyrant sort of way, but just an acknowledgement of their authority. So really, I mean, like Tristan was saying, this whole idea that kings are inherently tyrannical and whatnot. There's that quote from The Patriot where Mel Gibson's character says, you know, he'd rather have one tyrant or 1 mile away than 3,000 tyrants 1 mile away is worse than one tyrant 3,000 miles away. And that's a very kind of, again, Enlightenment tainted idea. But it's basically to say that, you know, democracy, republicanism, it's no more benevolent or, you know, conductive to the rights of man than kingship is. And I would argue that kingship, especially in the sense that, you know, these people are of a superior spirit and bloodline, they are more well equipped and suited to making decisions for communities, for, you know, peoples, than the mob, more or less.
So, Mr. Andre, there is a difference between how we understand king today, how kings were kind of understood in the Middle Ages or maybe the late medieval period, and then kingship in the Teutonic era or the ancient Germanic era. Could you specify maybe the differences between those?
Well, to connect it to what has already been said here about, you know, the Enlightenment philosophy, this idea of kings as tyrants, those who usurp the rights of people to rule themselves and so forth, to some degree, this had historically had a certain degree of basis in truth, in that not all who are claimed to be kingly are of a kingly essence, essentially. In the sense that these people who we consider tyrants, those who are seen as tyrants, were acting as kings were with all the privilege that came with being a king, but acted without the responsibility. And I feel that was the most important differentiating factor between the Middle Ages, the ancient times, and today, especially in ancient times, where this idea of kingship, it wasn't just a title. It wasn't something you just were born into. It was a measure of your soul. It was a measure of your quality. This idea of nobility, when we think of the word nobility today, we are thinking fat cats on top who have been rich for generations for unknown reasons, and they just do weird stuff that we, the common people, don't know anything about. Like, we don't know what they're actually doing. But the idea of nobility is more of a quality of the soul. It's a quality of your person. It's your honor. Your honor can be noble. Your goals can be noble. And that is primarily what I think differentiates, is that kings before used to have a responsibility. They had a responsibility to be a good ruler. They had to be a good king. Because there was always a chance that if someone wasn't a good king, there was someone who was gonna be a good king. Your title didn't necessarily keep you safe if you were an incompetent buffoon. You weren't supposed to be incompetent. Being incompetent was completely opposite of what it meant to be a king.
Yeah, I find it rather ironic that in the modern era, the notions of nobility and kingship have basically been merged or conflated with what is effectively an upjumped bourgeois, like merchants and everything of that sort. They, you know, we think of the upper class, the elite, as being basically just rich people, and that's very much very different from an early medieval perspective on the upper class.
Go ahead, Andre.
No, and I was going to say that while we have royal houses still alive today, what you see is not direct lineages. You see deviant lineages mixed in with all kinds of other lineages. And it's if you go deep into different monarchies and look at their relations to each other and so forth, it starts getting really complicated really fast. It's not a clear lineage that the king of Spain is a direct descendant of the first noble kings of Spain, or same thing with Norway. Things change and people intermarry. Sometimes they didn't even intermarry amongst nobility. They intermarried into, as you said, Tristan, upjump merchants because they were low on funds.
Yeah, Rothschild.
And this created a disconnect.
Yeah, the British royal family today are related to the Rothschilds. The Rothschilds have no primordial European blood. They're not part of the very first lines of kings that we're going to talk about today. They're just, you know, upjump bourgeois international bankers that bought their way into that. And now they're part of the framework. So our understanding of, and we said a lot of it is because of Hollywood. You know, people watch these movies and they see like ancient aristocracy, I don't want to say ancient, but maybe medieval aristocracies, or they look at lords and ladies and the courts of the kings, and they see these like lavish, haughty, highfalutin, arrogant, loafing, just like goofballs that are just, you know, sitting in their high tower and are just a bunch of limp wrists, when this is actually the opposite. The lordly class in the ancient times were a warrior class, and this even went into Christian times. You know, like what is the biggest aesthetic? What is the most recognizable symbol of the Middle Ages? That is the knight. And what is the knight? Well, in Germanic tradition, we would understand a knight as somebody that is Dränger, somebody that is noble, somebody that spends their life perfecting martial prowess. They were masters of war and upholders of justice. They weren't just some haughty, limp-wrist, you know, goofball Fanook that hung out in a castle and drank wine all day.
And in that sense, too, I think, like I was saying earlier, a lot of knights and stuff, especially, you know, in continental and northern Europe, They're most famous for their deeds as, like, you know, crusaders and whatnot. That's what a lot of the Tradcath people kind of like about them. But that really is just the Teutonic martial spirit, you know, applied to this, you know, new religion that, frankly, they didn't really convert to at heart. It was very superficial in a lot of cases early on. But, you know, like you just said, that they are masters of war and, you know, arbiters of justice. And so to me, even if these men are, you know, like professed Christians that converted or their forefathers converted, when I see their deeds, you know, and I read about them, I just think, you know, that's like, you know, tears watching over these guys. It's very much like their whole purpose, their whole sense of being, however they present it themselves, it aligns with, you know, tears, you know, role as Lord, you know, God of justice and, you know, strategy and war and whatnot.
Yeah, like the stand of the Swiss Guard was at in the
1527.
Yeah.
Damn, that was
like
close, though.
Like, that matters. But in the 15, yeah. It was in the 1500s. It was like the Swiss Guard, which are just like, I don't even know how many. There was like a couple hundred of them. And they fought off an entire army and, like, down to the last guy. Like, that's, you know, it doesn't matter where you are in history or what you know, religion you are or anything. That is boss mode right there. That is what a man does. That is very Indo-European, and the Allfather smiled on them when they did that.
And who are the Swiss or the Swiss Guard? You know, they're that elite military regiment that guards the Pope in Vatican City, drawn from Switzerland. You know, who are the Swiss? They're Alemannic Germans, more or less.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's kind of get in, because we actually each did some research on one of our favorite kings in history, and I want to get into that. But before we segue into talking about our kings, I want to talk about us as religious people that practice the ancestral faith. What do ancient kings have to do with us? Well, for those of us that practice this religion and practice, you know, whether you call it Asatru or heathenry or Setianism or whatever moniker you use, you observe reincarnation. And if you accept what our ancestors accepted, that the ancient kings were indeed these great, great men, these Drangr, these great heroes and champions and paragons of justice, and many of them went on to sire entire nations of people that we are indeed related to, somebody mentioned earlier. So if we believe in reincarnation and we observe the greatness of these men and these kings, we, you know, it's not a far leap to understand that these men will one day come back. And I know we've mentioned it on quite a few podcasts in the past. The reason that we give people names, why there's Junior and Second and Third and blah, 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 why, you know, John might be John the 12th or whatever. We do that so we could call people back from the afterlife to be reborn into the family line and come back to this world. So those of us that practice this faith, you know, we talk about ancestor veneration a lot. We talk about worshiping the gods a lot, obviously. One thing that kind of gets overlooked, in my opinion, is king veneration, which kind of goes into ancestor veneration, but king veneration or king worship, hero worship, because what you're essentially doing is you're calling them from the other world to come be reborn. And what does it say at the end of Voluspa? It talks about the return of Baldur and how he's going to usher in an age of kings. So, you know, I take it very, very seriously. My clan, my kindred, we actually just recently renamed ourselves to fit in with the kind of the new system of how we're doing clans and everything like that. We call ourselves now the Schaeferling Sippschaft. And Sippschaft is an old German word for like a clan or something like that. But Schaeferling means those of King Skef, those of King Skeva. And I'm going to talk about King Skeva tonight, but the reason that we did that was because we started to really take it seriously, the worship and the veneration of these primordial ancient kings, these true kings that had this divine spark, so they could come back to this world and rule once again in justice and piety and strength. And that's something that, and I'm going to tell you guys, the Schaeferlings, since we took on the name of King Skeva for our clan, there's been a whole new energy with us, whole new energy. We're healthier, we're stronger, people are more pious. There's just like a whole new essence of strength that has gone, and we've all noticed it. Many of us have been losing lots of weight, been getting into the gym, we're feeling stronger. People are getting, it's crazy what's going on. There's like a stroke of luck or something very powerful, energizing has come into my kindred since we've done that, since we've started to invoke the name of King Skaven. But, and I'm going to talk about King Skaven at length. I have so many notes. There's no way we have enough time to hit all the notes. I know quite a few of these other guys got notes, so we're going to get right into it and start with Mr. Ian has a very interesting ancient king and warlord. So, Mr. Ian, how about you tell us about the guy that you researched?
Well, I chose, actually, I suggested it kind of as a joke to Tristan because I was indecisive because there are a lot of cool kings in history. But I ultimately went with Attila the Hun, or as we might call him, Atli Khan, Atli being his name in the Old Norse and Khan being the Eurasian kind of title of king and whatnot. So the reason I chose him is because I think I've mentioned it before, but one of my earliest memories is reading kind of a child's version of like the Volsunga saga and the related sagas, pertaining to Atli and the descendants of Sigurd and all that stuff. So he was that whole setting was always very interesting to me. And when I was a kid, I saw on History Channel, it was some a historical fiction kind of, well, not historical fiction, but a very fictionalized movie. I think they had Gerard Butler as Attila the Hun, but I don't even recall it really. I just remember liking it. And then in fifth grade, I was in that GATE program for all the smarty pants kids. And we had to do these projects on these big tri-poster boards. And I ended up choosing, doing Attila and the Huns, much to the dismay of my teacher because she wasn't really into that sort of thing. But, I did that, and from there, which was age 10, from then on, I always had this fascination with the Huns. And kind of ironically is that I found the Goths to be kind of a weak people. And, disclaimer on that, because I ended up very much amending that idea. But as a youthful person, especially a young man, is inclined to be, they respect strength and victory and, the Goths lost and were assimilated or enslaved, so they're not really worthy of my attention or respect. Well, joke's on me. Most of my ancestry actually comes from places where the Goths used to live. So it's kind of like the womp womp of realizing that these same people that childhood me was spiting as losers are the same people that more or less were my forebears going back far enough. So I've always had that interest in particular, but like Dave was just saying, there is an ancestral veneration part of this, that the idea that your family or that your clan is connected via being under the rule or literal descent from these kings is important. And I had a dream some time ago that it was pertaining to Attila, and he kind of scared me in a way your boss might scare you if they're kind of heavy-handed and, angry. Because the sense in the dream was just that he was superior to me and that I should beware of his wrath. And because of that, I kind of started deep diving, learning about the Goths. And that's really where my opinion started to shift, that these people weren't just weakling Germanics that got conquered by the Huns. They were powerful kingdoms and tribes in their own right that were, ground down through wars with each other and with Rome, and ultimately some of them willingly joined the Hunnic confederations in pursuit of power over their rivals and wealth. But so I chose Attila because he's a very famous figure, and in my opinion, he's responsible for the birth of the West in many ways, because his shattering of the Western Empire really enabled the migrating Germanic peoples to really pick up the pieces and reforge it in their own image. And so in a way, even if he's not related to any Germanic peoples, although I would contest that he is, I think it's important to recognize that Attila's actions are responsible for the fact that a lot of Europe became Germanic. When he emptied the Balkans, when he emptied a lot of Eastern Gaul, that enabled a lot of Teutonic settlement and population explosion. I could talk for hours about him in a historic sense, so I'm going to forego that. And I want to talk specifically about his Gothic origins, because a lot of people, scholars included, they often assign to Attila and the Huns this very Turco-Mongol kind of identity and character. And for obvious reasons, the Huns are pretty much confirmed to be Eurasian steppe people from, you know, northwestern China. But at that time, people need to keep in mind there were also Scythians like the Wu Sun in the area. So the Huns, by nature, as a tribal confederation, are probably not going to be ethnically homogenous. But even so, Turks and Mongols are different peoples, and so a Turkic confederation like the Xiongnu moving west isn't necessarily the same as the Mongol invasions that would come later. And so along the way, as these Xiongnu are moving west, they're assimilating Scythian groups like Sarmatians and Alans and whatnot. And then when they crash into what is now modern Ukraine, that is where the Ostrogothic kingdoms are, like in Arnhem and whatnot. So as they're, you know, taking it to these Eastern Germanic groups and Scythian groups, many of them are killed, many are enslaved, many join willingly, many are conquered and assimilated. And in fact, archaeology kind of confirms that, because once that these groups really collide with each other, there's no real distinction between them in terms of their material goods, like their grave goods and whatnot. And it also seems that the Huns took on a lot of Gothic practices, like cranial changing, the weapons and gear used in war and stuff. They still retain their style of warfare, like with the horse archery and all that. But there was an interchange, an exchange of culture and material goods and religious ideas, I'm sure, between these peoples, and to the point of blood as well. I mean, the Huns are notorious for rape and pillaging and whatnot. And so the idea that there weren't a lot of, you know, Gothic Hunnic bastards running around is kind of ludicrous. But from there, we get the idea that Attila is likely Germanic, because the thing is, like I said, these are tribal confederations. They're not ethnically homogenous. They're generally formed of several tribes uniting and acknowledging the overlordship of one man, or in the Hunnic case, two men, because they often had a co-regency kind of thing going on. So beginning in the late 4th century, the Hunnic Confederation swept through the Pontic Steppe and into the Balkans, where they raided, you know, the Goth kingdoms and tribes in the area, Rome, but they also worked as mercenaries for different factions, including the Roman Empire. But they lacked social cohesion, so even though they settled in Pannonia, they were attacked by the Goths and, you know, some Roman groups, and they scattered and, you know, fled. There is the idea posed by Otto Mencken-Helfen and other scholars that they attempted to appeal to their fellow Huns to the east for help, but it never came. So they kind of lost this territory and never really sought to reclaim it. So things quieted down on the Eastern Front for a little while. But then you have the reign of, you know, Attila's uncles, because his father, contrary to popular belief, Munzuk, was not really a king of the Huns. He was just the brother of the two co-regents. There was a fourth brother named Ebisarius, but he also was not a king. There were two co-regents who were Oktar and Ruga, and their two brothers, likely their younger brothers, were not co-regents. They were just, you know, kind of next in line. So they divided their rule into east and west, much like the Romans would do. And Ruga is the one who ruled the Western Huns, and we know this because the Romans' enemy is Ruga. They don't really talk about Oktar much, so we can kind of assume that Oktar was the leader of the Eastern Huns and probably did more of their wars with the Sassanids and stuff like that. But Tristan, this is a question I had for you. I can't help but wonder if Oktar and Ruga are kind of Germanic in their origins, because Oktar sounds dangerously close to Ottokar, which is, you know, a Germanic name, and Ruga sounds dangerously close to, you know, Rugi, and the Rugi were a Germanic tribe largely believed to have assimilated into the Gothic, you know, tribal substructure, and were, you know, those Gothic peoples that were assimilated by the Huns. Do you know anything about those two names, or do you think that stands up? I couldn't find anything in my source.
Right. I mean, I do think that it does stand up, and several different scholars have mentioned that it's basically the case. We have Otto Mencken-Helfen here, who also says that he includes the name both Rugala and Oktar amongst those of Germanic or Germanicized origin. Without any derivation, he compares it to the names Rugamiris and Rugolf. And Dennis Seynord considered the name an initial R not of Altaic origin. And Altaic would be like the Turkish stuff. So he also agrees that it's of Germanic origin.
Right. And then the thing to remember, too, is that the Rugi, the Skiri, and the Gepidae, and the Gepids are a branch of the Goths. They were already part of the Hunnic Confederation. These were some of those tribes that kind of more or less willingly joined up to attack their rivals and get rich doing it. So Auchtorn Rugula might have been Olden's sons, who was another Hunnic king, but they might have also just been relatives. It's not really clear. But there is the theory that the tribe that ultimately spawned Auchtorn Rugula, Munzuk, Attila, Bled, etc., was one of the more westerly Hunnic tribes and was pretty minor, but then came to prominence as a result of, you know, good leadership and success, and came to dominate this confederation. Now, based on these names and the fact that the archaeological evidence suggests the Huns assimilated the Goths pretty quickly, I think it's really easy to make the case that the Hunnic Confederation as we know it isn't Turco-Mongol steppe people entirely. It's more of a, you know, Eurasian Gothic kind of horde in general with many sub-tribes, but I think a lot of these Western tribes, like the theorized tribe that Attila and his family would have belonged to, were highly likely very Gothicized, even if not in blood, in culture and sociology, more or less. As I said, that these kings, they were co-regents, and there's no distinction between them. Like, it wasn't like one of them was in charge of priestly duties and the other was more of a warlord. They seemed about equal, just geographic, you know, divisionaries. One was east, one was west. So when Attila became king, he was the western one, and his brother Bleda was the eastern one until he murdered him in, I think, 445. But the point here is that Attila's name, too, is actually a Gothic word, which means more or less little father. It's an East Germanic word. It's the Gothic or Gepidic noun Atta, which is father, and the diminutive suffix Illa, which means little, so, you know, little father. The Gothic etymology was the Brothers Grimm, actually, I think, was the first people to propose it in the 1800s. But Mencken-Helfen notes that the name doesn't have any phonetic or semantic difficulties, which means, you know, there's nothing really to contest this this translation or this interpretation of his name. Now, Attila's mother's name is not known, but the one given name that we have is Hunzjung, which I'm not sure of the origin, but it sounds kind of Germanic. It doesn't sound very Hunnic to me based on what other Hunnic names sound like. So my theory is that Attila's mother is likely a Goth. And so, therefore, Attila himself would be half-Goth. And the thing to remember, too, is while the Huns are described physically as being kind of squat and, you know, beady-eyed and, you know, angular face, they very much do fit the description of, you know, Eurasian steppe nomads mostly. But Attila, outside of his, you know, horribly cartoonish depictions as like Satan, is regarded as being kind of large and terrifying and powerful. So I find it kind of weird that if this is a purely Hunnic man, you know, a purely Eurasian man, that he's going to look so different from the rest of the people. And there is no firsthand account of his appearance.
I have seen depictions of him where people have depicted him as having red hair.
There are ideas like that. There's also people that go so far as to say that, you know, Chinggis Khan had red hair, which I think is kind of taking the Wu Sun meme a bit too far. But yeah, I think it's Attila, you know, being broad-shouldered and powerfully chested, or however he's described, I forget the exact terms, but it doesn't sound like a Hunnic man. It sounds like a Germanic man based on other descriptions in the contemporary period.
Yeah, especially if he had red hair. A lot of these ancient kings, because of Nordicism and because of you know, a lot of the Nordicism stuff that happened in the 1800s going into the early 1900s, we have this idea that everybody at some point was all blonde hair and blue-eyed, when in actuality, a lot of these ancient kings are depicted as having red hair. And if you read, you know, obviously in the Eddas, you know, Thor is described as a redhead. Now, that could be a symbolic thing. But, you know, the idea of everybody at one point being blonde is just, the blondicism stuff is just, it's off the mark.
Well, you know, it actually comes from a mistranslation of what the Roman, like Tacitus, said about the Germanic people. He refers to them as having flame-colored hair, and it's basically just an idiosyncrasy of our culture that we think flame is like, you know, like reddish or blonde or something, right? But the Romans basically interpreted flame as being anything from yellow to red to like a dark blondish color. I mean, it's basically just a mistranslation.
Oh, okay.
He was saying that they're fair haired in, you know, a Roman sense.
So we got a couple of donos here. We got Amer Arian donated 3 ice creams. Many blessings to you, Amer Arian. And also a genie from our boy, the Light of Decay, says, "Hail, King Skaeva." Hail, King Skaeva. We're going to talk about King Skaeva here in a minute here. But I want to pass it over to Mr. Andre, because Mr. Andre had some interesting stuff.
Well, I decided to go a little bit of a different route, actually, because I didn't choose a king that was necessarily that conventionally great, I would say. He wasn't necessarily a great conqueror. He wasn't one who brought nations and empires to their heel. But there was something when I first heard about him and when I first read about him that really struck a chord with me. And I really think it imbues really much of the spirit that we're talking about here. And that is King Radbod, if you're familiar with him.
Absolutely. Tell us about Radbod.
Yeah, Radbod was the king, or sometimes translated as the Duke of Frisia, during the 680s to 719. He was the last independent ruler of Friesenland, which is the coast of Netherlands, Germany, and parts of Denmark, if anybody's not familiar with that. And he was the one who brought the Frisian kingdom to its greatest extent before it slowly diminished. He was in a constant competition with the Frankish kingdom, and he fought bitterly against them to prevent Frankish dominion over the Frisian lands. What was interesting about him was that his predecessor was very open to the idea of Christianity, because he sought more of a unity with the Franks. But Radbod was a lot more hostile towards the idea of Christianity, because he felt it was a creeping influence towards the traditions, the values, and the independence of Frisia. He felt it was directly opposed to what he stood for. He was, however, known as he wasn't necessarily a great conqueror, because he was more of a defensive king. He defended the land of Frisia from the Franks, and he fought a bunch of wars with the Franks, including defeating Charles Martel of the Franks, which is the grandfather of Charlemagne. Ultimately, Charles Martel managed to outlast him. However, the story gets somewhat more interesting. Of course, it's shrouded in legend and mystery, as these histories often are. But the legend of it goes that during the travels of Saint Boniface, which you probably most people should be familiar with, he sent an ex-bishop and a monk called Wulfram to convert Radbod to Christianity. And after many, many, many talks and many, many failed convictions of trying to convince Radbod to convert to Christianity, ultimately there was a degree of doubt in Radbod, because they started to play on his love for his people, that it would be the best for him and his people to convert to Christianity in order to prevent the wrath of the Franks and destroy Frisia in its entirety. And the story goes that he was willing but reluctant to be baptized. And he stepped as far into the baptismal font as to have one foot in it before he looked towards Wulfram and asked, "You promised me heaven if I get converted, but will I meet my ancestors in heaven?" And Wulfram responded with a more of a snide remark, in a satisfactory manner, like, "No, you will not meet your ancestors in heaven. Your ancestors were all pagan. Therefore, they are burning in hell." And in a moment of rage and clarity, and absolute, what's the word I'm looking for? Reluctance and obstinance. He stepped out of the baptismal font, turned to Wolfram, the bishop, and said, I would prefer spending an eternity in hell with my ancestors than in heaven with a pack of beggars.
Wrecked.
And so his conversion was never completed. He was declared more of an enemy. He was almost declared a demon by the Catholics at the time as being the embodiment, the very image of the obstinate pagan who refused to give up his way. But even as the legend still goes there, that on his deathbed, he proclaimed an eternally free and pagan Frisia. The reason why this spoke so much to me was this absolute conviction towards his people, his tradition, and his faith, and his own honor, his own ancestors. He would be willing, even if it be so that they spoke true, he would still forsake his soul for the honor of his forefathers in hell rather than to go to heaven, where he had nothing to do, and he would be an honorless schmuck surrounded by beggars and monks and nothing else.
That is the ultimate Chad mood. That hits you in the feels there.
Oh, absolutely. That's exactly why I chose him. He's not a grand conqueror, but in a way, this is a really powerful man, and I really would think he's the embodiment of a true noble ruler who refused to give in to the pressure in order to preserve the traditions, his faith, and the honor of his forefathers. Really emphasizing the fact here that the idea of abandoning the forefathers was probably something a lot of Christian converts struggled with. And this man, this king, Radbod, refused to do so. And I would make the case here. There is a modern disconnect because a lot of people, I've seen a lot of people actually talk about, you know, Radbod and so forth, and, you know, they don't get the big deal. Why didn't they just do it? I would say that this idea that we hear is when we hear about all these conversions, especially these successful conversions of these kings, these chieftains, and these jarls and so forth, we don't realize the impact this would have had, this impact of conversion at this time, because I think we have I guess we could almost blame it on a degree of, you know, atheism, I suppose, like the prevalent atheistic thought, that the soul is not that vital, the soul is not that important, you know. But for these people in the medieval age, this was a matter of eternal life or eternal death. This was far bigger and grander. This was not an easy decision to make for these people. This is why this one speaks so strongly to me, this idea of this obstinance in face of even a truly astounding enemy, such as the creeping influence of the Franks and the Christians. He refused to bend the knee, and he still somehow managed to live until his old age, proclaim a free and eternally pagan Frisia. And even before his death, he still allegedly made the Franks cover in fear at the very rumor of him gathering an army. This man was powerful, and his faith was something we should absolutely look up to. His faith was unquestioning.
Yeah. I bet Wolfram was a little bit shocked when he went to hell and went to the hell thing there. He's like, wait, this doesn't look like heaven? Oh, shit.
I think we can pretty safely say, though, that Radbod probably got his last laugh when he's sitting feasting with the Allfather himself.
Beautiful. Hail Radbod.
Hail Radbod.
So, Mr. Tristan, he's got a good one, too. He's got Hakon the Good.
No, I'm not doing Hakon the Good. That's a different king.
Excuse me?
Oh, who are you doing? Hold on.
I'm actually doing Hakon Jarl, which is a different king than Hakon the Good. Hakon the Good ruled before Hakon Jarl.
All right, well, tell us about him.
And I would have to basically warn everyone that
Mr. Tristan, it seems like your internet's cutting out real bad, bud.
My internet has been very...
Yeah, Tristan, we're losing you. We're losing you, buddy.
Choppy for the last, you know, couple weeks.
Tristan, we're losing you.
Come in. He rode Norway from 970.
Oh, yeah.
Man, it's like some kind of like sci-fi garbled transmission. Like, we're losing him. They're pulling him into the netherworld.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
All right. Like I was saying, it's going to happen. Just work with me, guys. Anyway, I'm doing Håkon Jarl, which his full name was Håkon Sigurdsson. He ruled Norway from 975 to 995, also known as Håkon the Powerful. Håkon was the son of Sigurd Håkonsson, Jarl of Lade and ruler of Trøndelag and Hålogaland. His mother was Bergljot, Tore's daughter of Tore Ragnvaldsson, Jarl of Moor. Adam of Bremen wrote that he was of the stock of Ivar, possibly Ivar the Boneless, and descended from a race of giants. In the sagas, Håkon claimed descent from the divine lineage of Saeming, who was the son of Odin. Snorri's Ynglingasaga relates that after the giantess Skathi broke off her marriage with Njord, she married afterward Odin and had many sons by him, of one whom was called Saeming, from whom Jarl Håkon claimed descent. However, in his preface to the Heimskringla, Snorri says that Eyvindr's Hallegjatal, which reckoned up the ancestors of Jarl Håkon, brought in Saeming as son of Yngvifeller. It's often thought that Snorri may have slipped here, thinking of the Ynglings, but I actually think there is something to be said about the issue he's brought up here, because we know from archaeological records that Skathi was very, very connected to the cult of Freyr, especially in Sweden and anywhere else that his cult was particularly popular. Which seems to be a little strange when you consider that the major and really the only myth about her is how much she didn't like Njord and basically didn't stay with him, right? So I'm thinking that in the myths, we probably have a missing record of some sort of son she's had with Njord or something of that sort, in which Saeming might actually be the son of Skathi and Njord instead of Skathi and Odin instead. But anyway, to continue on, Håkon became Jarl after his father was killed by King Harald Greycloak's men in 961. Håkon Jarl warred with King Harald for some time until he was forced to flee to Denmark, where he conspired with Harald Bluetooth against Harald Greyskin. The two arranged the death of Greyskin around 971, after which Harald Bluetooth invited his foster son to be invested with new Danish fiefs. Civil war broke out between Håkon Jarl and the surviving brothers of Harald Greyskin, but Håkon proved victorious. After this, Håkon Jarl ruled Norway as a vassal of Harald Bluetooth, but he was in reality an independent ruler. And this is where the title Håkon Jarl comes from. He could not refer to himself as a king because he was technically a vassal of the king of Denmark, but he referred to himself as Håkon Jarl of Norway's shore. For Harald, he attacked Gotland and killed its ruler, Ottar Jarl. Around 973 to 974, he went to Denmark to help Harald Bluetooth in his defense against the Holy Roman Emperor Otto II. Otto's forces successfully opposed an attempt by Harald to throw off the German yoke, and after that, Håkon paid no taxes to Denmark, seeing Bluetooth as a weak king. Håkon was a strong believer in the Norse gods, even after Harald Bluetooth forced him to accept baptism around 975 and assigned him clergymen to take to Norway to spread Christianity. When a favorable wind came for Håkon to leave, he commanded the clergymen to leap from the boat into the shallow water and swim ashore, and broke his allegiance to Denmark. And in 977, Vladimir I of Kiev fled to him, collecting as many of the Viking warriors as he could to assist him in the recover of Novgorod, and on his return the next year, marched against Jarlsfolk of Kiev. In 986, a Danish invasion fleet led by the fabled Jomsvikings was defeated at the Battle of Hjørungavágr, which is a very, very famous incident in the annals of Norwegian history. And I will be talking about, I picked up some of the poetic Eddas here to discuss some of the Battle of Hjørungavágr and in some of the issues from Heimskringla talking about Håkon Jarl. The first one comes from the Jomsvikingsdrápa, which is basically a funeral dirge for the famous Jomsvikings and their saga and their fight in the Hjørungavágr against Håkon Jarl. And it says, I have heard strife liberal Sigvaldi began the making of vows. The reckless Bui was swift to strengthen such daring. They vowed eagerly to drive Håkon from the land or rob him of life. The hatred of the famous men was grim. It is said that the fine men sailed their fleet of ships from the south across the waves. The cold sea drove against the poles of the battle fire. The rime-covered hulls beat the icy waves. The storms tested the men. The chill sea roared against the planking. Then those jarls of Norway forcefully bade their men to the spear storm against those who came from the south. The greatest force from the land was brought together there in a short time. Many a battle strengthener was at the play of Laufey. I have heard that Håkon defended the land hard so that nothing was lacking. Eirikr was not reluctant to redden sword edges, and men said that Armander was then the third commander there. That man was cheerful towards his men. Sigvaldi bade his attack strong band advance strongly.
Losing you, Mr. Tristan.
Against Håkon, who was not willing for settlement. The battle-keen heir of Harald, split helmet, proceeded at once to make a sacrifice. The harsh violence proceeded. And the ending part here is actually a rather famous incident where it talks about Håkon, who proceeds to make a sacrifice during the battle. When he was at the Battle of Hjörungavágr, he famously was very hard-pressed in the middle of the melee and called out to Odin in the press of battle, saying that he would sacrifice anything he wanted to him if he would give him victory. And it's famously known that at this exact time, Håkon's oldest son actually got sick and shortly passed away before the battle was over. And it was taken by our ancestors to believe that Odin took the son as the sacrifice to give him victory. And I also have a couple poems here from Heimskringla. The helm-crowned Håkon, brave as stout, again has put his foes to rout. The bull runs o'er with Odin's mead that fires the scald with mighty deed. Has to be sung, Earl Håkon's sword, in single combat, as I've heard. Three sons of earls from this one fray to dwell with Odin drove away. And as Håkon the Earl proceeded this summer along the coast, subjecting all the people to him, he ordered that over all his dominions the temples and sacrifices should be restored and continued as of old. So it is said in Villalekla. Håkon the Jarl, so good and wise, that all the ancient temples rise. Thor's temples raised with fostering hand that had been ruined throughout the land. His valiant champions who were slain on battlefields across the main, to Thor the Thunder God may tell how for the gods all turns out well. The hardy warrior now once more offers the sacrifice of gore. The shield bearer in Loki's game invokes once more great Odin's name. The green earth gladly yields her store as she was wont in days of yore. Since the brave breaker of the spears, the holy shrines again uprears. The Jarl has conquered with strong hand all that lies north of Viking land. In battle storm and iron rain, Håkon spreads wide his sword's domain. And again, there's another poem here which says, on the silent battlefield, in Viking garb with axe and shield, the warrior stranding over the slain asks of the gods what days will gain. Two ravens flying from the east come croaking to the bloody feast. The warriors knows what they foreshow, the days when Gotland blood will flow. A Viking feast Jarl Håkon kept, that land with Viking fury swept, harrying the land far from the shore where foray ne'er was known before. Leaving the barren cold coast side, he raged through Gotland far and wide, led many a gold-decked Viking shield or many a peaceful inland field. Bodies on bodies Odin found, heaped high upon each battleground. The moor, as if by witchcraft's power, grows green enriched by bloody shower. No wonder that the gods delight to give such luck in every fight to Håkon's men, for he restores their temples on our Norway shores. The Bondi's ships along the coast sailed on to meet the foeman's host. The stout Earl ships with eagle's flight rushed on the Danes in bloody fight. The Danish ships of courtmen full were cleared of men, and many a hole was driving empty on the maid with the warm corpses of the slain. 'Twas at the peep of day our brave Earl led the way, his ocean horses bounding, his war horns loudly sounding. No joyful morn arose for Yngve Freyr's base foes. Those Christian island men wished themselves home again. And that ends the poems from Heimskringla, which is unfortunately leads to a very sad end to our Håkon Jarl here. Håkon Jarl was killed by his trusted thrall, Tormund Kark, in his sleep, while hiding in the pigsty of a farm after having a civil war with the eventual king of Norway, Olaf Tryggvason.
Bastard.
Yeah, he really is.
I love that the guy who stuck a spear through his heart had the last name Hund.
That is an interesting remark.
You would like that.
I do like that. That's awesome.
But what people would know going through all of these poems is that Håkon is renowned for basically resurrecting all of the temples throughout all of Norway, which had been pillaged by the Christian men who had ruled previously. And he was very well renowned for his agricultural prosperity. Apparently the gods loved him and gave him lots of riches. There's also a rather interesting remark here in the last poem I said, where it talks about, "For Yngvi Freyr's base foes, these Christian island men wish themselves home again," which I found rather relevant because it specifically identifies Christians as Yngvi Freyr's base foes.
Wow. Real quick, we got a couple. We got a few donos here. We have Chris Waffen donates 8 lemons. Folkish Farmer celebrating 3-month sub streak, and he donates a guinea. Much love and many blessings to our boy Folkish Farmer. We're gonna have him back on very soon. We have Letty Decay with a diamond. Much love and many blessings to each and every one of you guys. So, Mr. Tristan, we have only a few minutes left, but we're gonna go over a little bit because I want to get into King Skef. Does that conclude Håkon Jarl?
That does. I'm all the way done.
Beautiful. Hail Håkon Jarl. So, my king that I chose, and as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, was my clan, my kindred, renamed ourselves to go in with the system of the Riggs thing. And we did a whole show about that. You can go watch the episode on the Riggs thing. And then Folks Farmer gifted 1-month subscription to users in this channel. Letty Decay just received a 1-month subscription from Folkish Farmer. Very, very cool. Bog Lords everywhere. Many hails, many blessings to Folkish Farmer. So my choice was the namesake of my clan, my newly founded clan, my transformed clan. And he goes by many names. We call him King Skeva, which is a later evolution of his name. But some of the Saxon sources call him King Skef, and that's what a lot of people know him to be, King Skef. Now, King Skef is a very, very interesting king because academics for a long time assumed that he was just myth, that he was just a story, even though, and we're going to get into this, even though many of the kings later on from all over Europe named him as their who sired them, many nations, the Lombards, many Saxons, the Æthelings, the Skildungs, who are a very well-known Swedish clan, many, many clans, the Lombards, hailed him as their sire. So King Skef, what is very interesting about him, and this is why atheist academics, very much believed that he was a myth. Because as the story goes, and this is in multiple accounts, and we're going to read, I'm going to try to get through all of them, many of them show that he arrived as a young boy on a raft with laying on a bed of either corn or wheat or something like that. Now, wheat is corn. A lot of people don't realize that because we understand wheat today, but the ancient grain of wheat, and you know, Mr. Folks Farmer's in the chat, and he's the guy that taught us this. The ancient grain of wheat that we used to eat was called einkorn because it was corn. So there's not much of a differentiation between corn and wheat when you're reading in archaic texts. When they mention corn, they could be talking about wheat or they could be talking about maize, is what we understand corn to be.
Right. I mean, corn was basically an archaic term for anything that was like a cereal crop that you'd eat, like oats, barley, wheat, anything of that sort was all termed corn.
Exactly. So, not to talk too much about corn, but King Skef shows up on this bed of wheat in this raft onto the shores of Europe as this beautiful, shining young man, this young boy. And he goes on and he grows up to be this great king, and he fathers these many different tribes and nations and stuff like that. And a lot of he's shrouded in mystery, a lot of it. However, I do not recognize it as just myth. I 100% believe that he was a real man that walked this earth. And I believe that he was a divine spark, and I believe that He was either the earthly manifestation of Heimdall or perhaps Ing, either one. And I'm going to get into a lot of his stuff here. So let's get into some of the chronicles. Speaking of the Aethelings, this says, and I'm going to give credit. I grabbed a lot of this off of William Reeves' site, GermanicMythology.com, because he already had it all just ordered and put in together. And in William Reeves' honor, I'm going to... There's no way I could have proposed his entire theory on how King Skef was the earthly manifestation of Heimdall. So I just picked one little paragraph off of there. Because if anyone here that's familiar with William Reeves, if you get into one of his theories, there is a lot of stuff. You have to go through a lot of material. William Reeves is one of the most thorough academics you'll see. But you know, so shout out to William Reeves, GermanicMythology.com. Here he says, concerning Skef, Aethelweards, who's a member of the Aethelings clan, Chronicon Aethelwardi, composed in the late 10th or early 11th century, records the following in Book 3 concerning the year 855. Now, I'm going to say there are quite a few sources that dispute the year of his existence. So a lot of people will say that he was around in 100 BC. Some people will say that he was in obviously late AD times or whatever. But there's a lot of debate around that. I actually believe that he was in the late BC times. Like we're talking 100 BC around that time, because there are some... I'm not going to talk about it too much because it's still something that's in that we're researching, but I believe that we have found genetic markers that show that this guy had a profound genetic effect on the populations of Europe around 100 BC, and I believe that he did live to be a very, very advanced age. I believe this guy did live well over his hundreds because he was indeed a divine man. And this Skef arrived with one light ship in the island of the ocean, which is called Scanny, with arms all around him. He was very young boy and unknown to the people of that land, but he was received by them, and they guarded him with diligent attention as one who belonged to them and elected him king. From his family, King Aethelwulf derived his descent. From the 12th century historian William of Malmesbury, in his De Gentis Regum Anglorum, describes the same scene this way. This Skef, they say, landed on an island in Germany called Skansa, mentioned by Jordanes, the historian of the Goths, as a small child in a ship without a crew, sleeping with a sheaf of wheat laid by his head, and hence called sheaf. The men of that country welcomed him as something miraculous and brought him up carefully, and on reaching manhood he ruled a town they called Slasvik, but now Hadeby. The name of the region is Old Anglia, and it was from there that the Angles came to Britain. It lies between the Saxons and the Goths. So both of these historical accounts are describing him kind of coming from this miraculous place, having very mysterious divine origins. He's even mentioned in Beowulf. Here's Beowulf. Listen ye, of the Spear Danes in the days of yore, of those clan kings heard of their glory, how those nobles performed courageous deeds. And the translation, it says, Hjúta Hethelinga Ellen Freymunden, which means, it says Aethelinga, which means the Aethelings, not necessarily nobles. It's not necessarily good translation, but how those Aethelings performed courageous deeds, often skilled Skef's son from enemy hosts, from many people seized mead benches and terrorized the fearsome Heruli. After first he was found helpless and destitute, he then knew recompense for that. He waxed under the clouds, throve in honors, until to him each of the bordering tribes beyond the whale road he had to submit and yield tribute. That was a good king. To him an heir was born then, young in the yards, God sent him. And keep in mind, Beowulf is a Christian document. So, to comfort the people, he had seen the dire distress that they suffered before leaderless, a long while them for that life, Lord, ruler of glory, granted honor on earth, Beowulf was famed, his renown spread wide, Scyld's heir in northern lands. So ought a young man by good deeds deserve, and by fine treasure gifts while in his father's keeping, that him in old age shall again stand by, willing companions when war comes. People serve him by glorious deeds must, amongst his people, everywhere, one prosper. Then Scyld departed at the destined time, still in his full strength to fare in the protection of Lord Freyr. So this is talking about this, and this goes into Tristan's theory that King Skef was a manifestation or a child of Yngve Freyr, Lord Frey himself, or Lord Yng himself. They carried to the sea surf his dear comrades, as he himself had bid. And when he yet wielded words, that friend of the Scyldings, beloved ruler of the land, had ruled for a long time, there at the harbor stood with a ringed brow, icy and keen to sail a hero's vessel, and they laid down the beloved prince, the giver of rings and treasure in the bosom of the boat, the mighty by the mast. Many riches were there, from far-off lands ornate armor and baubles were bought. I have not heard of a comelier keel adorned with weapons of battle and war dress. And there's more and more and more. But that is a reference to him in Beowulf. So it goes on and it says here, this kind of goes into, and this goes into the theory of William Reeves, that he was the earthly manifestation of the god Heimdall, and Heimdall is the shining god, the whitest of the gods. He is the priest of the gods. And this is a very interesting quote here. He says, as previously mentioned, Danish sources list Skef as the sons of Lothuris, who is most likely a historical version of Odin's brother Lothur, and probable founder of either the Vanir or Alfar tribe. Saxo says that Lothuris usurped the throne of his brother Humbel, who may be a cognate of Honir. If so, then Lothur has ruled both the Vanir and the Alfar. If Skef is a by name of Heimdall, this opens up the real possibility that Heimdall is actually the son of Odin's brother Lothur. Lothur, whose name means the blazing, is an appropriate father for Heimdall. The Fitastir. I'm having trouble with this word here, which means the whitest or brightest of the gods. Mr. Tristan, what do you think about William Reeves' reasoning there?
Well, I mean, it sounds rather consistent based on Snorri's description of everything there. I would probably say that the connection with the Alfar and the Vanir here would actually play much heavier into my theory about King Skef being either a son or a manifestation of Yngve Freyr, being as Yngve Freyr himself obviously is of the Vanir and rules the Alfar.
And here's another thing, and this is going to be coming up in the next thing that I'm about to read. But King Skef himself is very much associated with successful agrarian life. And if we look at the timeline, around that time, like we were talking 100 BC, around that time in Northern Europe was when they started to really get in with agriculture. That's when they started to become successful with agriculture. So the timeline of technology, the development of agriculture, genetic markers, and many other indicators say that King Skef was a real man. He was a real king that sired real people. Alboen, king of the Lombards, claimed him. The Aethelings claimed him. Even Alfred the Great, who was an Aetheling, claimed him to be who sired the Aethelings, his family line, and he was a Christian. The Scyldungs, who went on to become a very famous tribe in Sweden. But I wanted to end on this because this was really special to me. I really, really like this. This is actually, I have no idea how he came up with this, but this is actually from J.R.R. Tolkien. And this is from, I believe it was like one of the last things that he wrote. I believe it was called The Lost Roads, and it was published after he died. And he wrote a poem about King Skef. He writes, I'm going to see, here we go. In the days of yore, out of deep ocean, to the Lombards in the land dwelling, that of old that held amid the isles of the north, a ship came sailing, shining timbered, without oar and mast, eastward floating, the sun behind it sinking westward, with flame kindled the fallow water. Wind was wakened over the world's margin. Clouds gray-helmed climbed slowly up, wings unfolding wide and looming as mighty eagles moving onward. To eastern earth, omen-bearing, men were marveled in the midst standing. Of the dark islands in the depths of time, laughter they knew not, light nor wisdom. Shadow was upon them, and sheer mountains stalked behind them stern and lifeless. Evil-haunted, the east was dark. The ship came shining to the shore driven, and strode upon the strand till its stem rested. On sand and shingle the sun went down, the clouds overcame the cold heavens. Is this, Tristan, would you say that this is in Lodahattermeter?
You know, to be entirely honest, I can't say based on what you were just saying. I'm not that familiar with the sacred meters, and when I do write in them, I have to specifically use very, very intense notes to make sure I get it right.
Yeah, I think some of this is trying to replicate the holy meter of the ancient poetry. I just recognize this just now. That's really incredible. The clouds go in fear and wonder to the fallow water. Sad-hearted men swiftly hastened to the broken beaches, the boat seeking, gleaming timbered in the gray twilight. They looked within, and there laid sleeping a boy they saw breathing softly. His face was fair, his form lovely, his limbs were white, his locks raven. Gold braided, gilt and carven, with wondrous work was the wood about him. See, wondrous work was the wood about him. Three W's. That's sacred.
Yeah, listening to it, I do think you are right about the identification here.
In golden vessel, gleaming water stood behind him, strung with silver. A harp of gold neath his hand rested, his sleeping head was soft pillowed. On a sheaf of corn, shimmering palely, as the fallow gold doth from far countries, west of Angel, wonder filled them. There's still more. This goes on. This is actually a pretty long poem, but we'll skip ahead here. This is the last little bit here. Halls and houses hone of timber, strong towers of stone steeped and lofty. Golden gabled in his guarded city they raised and roofed, and his royal family dwelling. Of wood well carven the walls were wrought, fair-hued figures filled with silver. Gold and scarlet gleaming hung there, stories boding of strange countries. Were one wise in wit the woven legends to thread with thought at his throne men found. Counsel and comfort and cares healing, justice and judgment generous handed. His gifts he gave, glory was uplifted. Far sprang his fame over fallowed water. Through northern lands the renown echoed of the shining king, Sheev the Mighty. Seven sons he begat, sires of princes, men great in mind, mighty handed, and high hearted from his house cometh. The seeds of kings, as songs tell us, fathers of the fathers who before the change, in the elder years the earth governed, northern kingdoms named and founded. Shields of their peoples, Sheev begat them, Sea Danes and Goths, Swedes and Northmen, Franks and Frisians, folk of the islands, swordmen and Saxons, Swabes and English, and the Longobards who long ago beyond Mirkvudu's mighty realm and wealth won them in the Welsh countries, where Elfwine, Aedhwine's heir, in Italy was king, all that has passed. And that's what Tolkien wrote. I highly suggest it's such a beautiful poem. And if you want an English version of understanding what the sacred meter sounds like, I'm sure you guys recognize, and I just want to point this out here. Let me find a good sentence here. So, The ship came shining to the shore driven, and strode upon the strand until its stem rested. You see how it's like ship shining shore, strode, strand, stem? That's how the ancient poetry was put together. It wasn't like how it is today when we understand rhymes in poetry. It was very much this this kind of meter here. So I highly recommend. And that I'm just really astounded and impressed that Tolkien just proves once again that he had a divine spark in his hand when he wrote things. He put this in the sacred meter. That's really incredible to me. So anyway, this is the story of King Scef. This is the story of King Scaferling, or Skava, from which my clan, the Scaferlings, are named. And I don't believe that he was just a myth. There are too many indicators. There's too much evidence that he walked the earth, and he fathered all of these different people, and he did all of these different things, and he ruled, and he was a great man. He was a man of divine spark that came from probably a divine place. You know, how else could somebody just appear on shores on a raft? You know, the gods sent him. He was the primordial god king that so many of us are probably related to. So that's what I have to say about King Skava. And when we do offerings to King Skava, we offer him wheat and cereal and grain and stuff like that, and milk. Those are the offerings that we give him, because he is the king of agriculture. He was the bringer of agriculture, and he was a very virile father figure. And now that I'm reading all of this and this all clicked for me, I actually agree with Tristan's theory that he was an earthly manifestation of Yngve Freyr. So, to me, this is just evidence. This is proof that our gods are 100% real. They put kings on this earth. Earthly manifestations of them walk the earth. We have evidence of this. And it just further shows that our ancestral religion is indeed legitimate. And it's just incredible. Hail King Skava.
Hail King Skava.
Beautiful. So, I'm sorry, I went on for a long time. I didn't realize I got really swept up in the poem and everything like that. Sorry about that.
No, I'm sure we were all sitting here enjoying the audio drama.
Well, I was sitting there thinking, I'm sure his kids love story time.
Yeah, I get into it. I really like it. I really like it. So, yeah, when I started, especially like the poetry, and there was just something about the Tolkien poem that I felt it, and I just got the flow going and stuff like that. And I like to bring these words to life to the best of my ability. And
well, it certainly beats being monotonous. You know, that no one likes that.
Yeah.
And then King Skafa came to shore. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're a good storyteller.
Thank you, sir. So, when Miss April says she loved it. Chris says beautiful poem, wonderful. Yeah, guys, go check out the story of King Skava by J.R. Tolkien in his book The Lost Road. I highly recommend it. Beautiful, beautiful poem in the ancient meter, the holy meter. So, what I want to kind of end on is for folks that want to make offerings to these great kings and call to them to the other world and ask them to come back and lead us once again and grace this world with their might and their strength, how would you guys suggest people make offerings to the kings that you described tonight? Mr. Ian.
Oh, God, that might be controversial. how to call upon Attila? Well, I suppose like the severed head of a Roman might work, but maybe for legal reasons, don't do that. Also, Romans aren't really around anymore, so a bit of difficulty there. But I think maybe a gold is not a common thing most people have. But if you had maybe a small metal coin or something like a silver coin or some kind of little gesture of wealth, you know, a piece of jewelry or something like that. I'm not saying go bury it in the backyard or nothing, but if you had maybe an altar and you wanted to, I don't know, maybe ask Atli's spirit to try to, I don't know if anyone would want to claim descent from him or whatnot, but if you wanted to invoke him for strength or for a regency, because contrary to popular, you know, myth, Attila actually was a pretty good king. He ruled over a large multi-ethnic empire and made it an incredible war machine and state. And with a lot like Alexander the Great, it didn't survive his death, but yeah, he still was, in my opinion, a very great king. And so I would say maybe gestures of wealth like that. Personally, if I were going to do it, I would put up on my altar, I would put a sword and a piece of jewelry, probably a necklace that I wear kind of wrapped around the hilt before I would say a prayer or something like that. Because, I mean, what is he known for? War and pillaging. And, you know, he allegedly wielded the Sword of Mars, which, as me and Tristan could again go on about, we believe is actually a very famous blade, perhaps even Graham. But, yeah.
So what would you think about somebody offering, like, a Goldschlager?
I think that would work all right.
So, Mr. Andre, how would you suggest somebody make an offering to Radbod?
Well, I would say, as a general rule, at least if you're of some kind of Frisian descent, you should make the ultimate offering by naming your child after him. Naming your child after a divine king or a divine ruler is, I would say, almost the ultimate offering. You're offering a life, you're offering an essence of life towards bringing back this person into this world again. Secondly, I would also say for Radbod, honor your gods, honor your country, honor your ancestors, and don't question why you honor your ancestors and your gods. Do not question why you do so. Just do it. It's a matter of loyalty. It's a matter of honor. It's a matter of respect.
Can I just add real quick something? Andre, you kind of made me think. Naming your children after kings and great figures and stuff, especially if they're relations of yours, is just a great thing to do, period, because not only are you kind of invoking their spirit and whatnot, but also you're really entrenching that bond and that relation into the modern mind, which is important for us to do.
Beautiful. Andre suggests make an offering of your own piety to King Radbod, because King Radbod was a man that was as pious as any. That was probably his greatest strength, was his piety and his devotion to his people and his gods and his tradition and his faith. So Mr. Tristan, how would you suggest somebody make an offering to Hakon Jarl?
Well, I would worship any ancient king as if doing so through the Alfar. In this case, I would either use an offering of milk and honey and alcohol, which could be left out as an offering, or there is an attested ritual in Cormac's saga in which, in order to please the Alfar, he basically sacrifices a bull over a hilltop and reddens the entire hill with its blood. So, you know, if you want to put down like $2,500 on sacrificing a bull, you could do that.
Yeah, I don't know. That's I know he's got $2,500 laying around for that, but that's pretty cool, though.
Well, I mean, if in practical matters, I feel like if you have the real intent to do so, like a good cut of beef is a good substitution. I'm not talking about like getting some like petite steak from the supermarket and doing it that way, but like a real good quality chunk of meat. And I know that it can be expensive, especially in economic conditions like the present day, but just an option to consider.
Yeah, or give him a cut of meat from the deer that you hunted.
Oh, yeah, that's a perfect example.
Wonderful. All right, fellas, we are up into an hour and a half, so we got to shut it down for this evening. But do we have anything in closing that we'd like to say?
I would still want to say and emphasize the fact Radbod, as a king, is something you should emulate. He is pious and he's loyal. And everybody should be. You should be loyal to your country. You should be loyal to your faith. And you should be loyal to your ancestors, no matter what.
Even in the face of death.
Even in the face of death, especially in the face of death.
Hear, hear.
Hail. So, hail to Hakon Jarl, hail to Attila the Hun, and hail to King Radbod, and hail to King Skeva. That's going to be it for tonight. But like always, make sure you stay for next week. What do we got on the charter for next week? What's on the itinerary Mr. Tristan.
I think we are actually doing the episode with Neil John next week.
Neil John. So speaking of Neil John, make sure to go over to Facebook.com/Iron Age Jodish and go check out some authentic Vedic astrology. Our boy Neil John is a genius with this stuff. He blew me away with the reading that he gave me. So if you want to check out what the stars have to say for you from the standpoint of authentic ancient Vedic astrology, go over to Facebook.com/Iron Age Jodish and hit up our boy Neil John. He's going to be on here next week. And tell him Big Dave sent you. Tell him Big Dave sent you. If you like the Bog, if you like the Return of the Ancient Kings episode, and if you like everything that we do and you want to support us on a regular basis, make sure to go over to patreon.com/thebog and sign up so we can help us keep the lights on, help us keep growing, and help us keep chasing our ambitions here on the Bog. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50, and you know, there's all kinds of stuff you get. I think there's stickers, t-shirts, and mugs, and like stuff that you get with the signing up as well. But the main thing is we have RSS feed for everybody that wants the audio of all of our shows, every single one we upload. I was kind of falling off behind a little bit, but I'm back on track with it. So if you want to get the RSS feed of every single one of the Bog episodes as it comes out, so you can listen to it in your car, on your commutes, at the gym, or at work, go over to patreon.com/thebog and sign up. Also, if you want to just support us by getting some sweet merch, make sure to go over to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop, and you can go get Light of Decay. There is a Bog tote bag over at the Bog shop. So you can go over to Bog shop. You get yourself a t-shirt. We got maternity shirts for the ladies out there that are carrying our beautiful children. We have dresses. We have tank tops. We have bucket hats. We have baseball caps. We have hoodies. We have everything you can think of is over there. So make sure to go over to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and go check out some of our merch. Help support us. Help us keep the lights on. And speaking of patrons, I got my horn right here. Hold up. Let me grab it. And I got some beer with me right here. I've been sipping on. I've been just waiting for this. So, to all of our exalted patrons, House Allen, our very own Andre, and our good friend Mr. Corey, we thank each and every one of you for your support as an exalted patron and supporter of the Bog. Many thanks. Many hails and many blessings. Hail!